The new imagery, with photography at its forefront, did not merely function as a supplement to language, but bid to replace it as our dominant means for construing, understanding, and testing reality. What Boorstin implies about the graphic revolution, I wish to make explicit here. The new focus on the image undermined traditional definitions of information, of news, and, to a large extent, of reality itself. First in billboards, posters, and advertisements, and later in such news magazines and papers as Life, Look, the New York Daily Mirror, and Daily News, the picture forced exposition into the background, and in some instances obliterated it altogether. By the end of the 19th century, advertisers and newspaper men had discovered that a picture was not only worth 1,000 words, but where sales were concerned, was better. For countless Americans, seeing, not reading, became the basis for believing. In a peculiar way, the photograph was the perfect complement to the flood of telegraphic news from nowhere that threatened to submerge readers in a sea of facts from unknown places about strangers with unknown faces. For the photograph gave a concrete reality to the strange-sounding datelines and attached faces to the unknown names. Thus it provided the illusion, at least, that the news had a connection to something within one's sensory experience. It created an apparent context for the news of the day, and the news of the day created a context for the photograph. But the sense of context created by the partnership of photograph and headline was, of course, entirely illusory. You may get a better sense of what I mean here if you imagine a stranger's informing you that the ilex is a subspecies of vermiform plant with articulated leaves that flowers biannually on the island of Aldenonjes. And if you wonder aloud, "Yes, but what has that to do with anything?" imagine that your informant replies, "But here is a photograph I want you to see," and hands you a picture labeled Ilex on Aldenonjes. "Ah, yes," you might murmur, "now I see." It is true enough that the photograph provides a context for the sentence you have been given, and that the sentence provides a context of sorts for the photograph, and you may even believe for a day or so that you have learned something. But if the event is entirely self-contained, devoid of any relationship to your past knowledge or future plans, if that is the beginning and end of your encounter with the stranger, then the appearance of context provided by the conjunction of sentence and image is illusory, and so is the impression of meaning attached to it. You will, in fact, have learned nothing, except perhaps to avoid strangers with photographs, and the ilex will fade from your mental landscape as though it had never been. At best, you are left with an amusing bit of trivia, good for trading in cocktail party chatter or solving a crossword puzzle, but nothing more. It may be of some interest to note in this connection that the crossword puzzle became a popular form of diversion in America at just that point when the telegraph and the photograph had achieved the transformation of news from functional information to decontextualized fact. This coincidence suggests that the new technologies had turned the age-old problem of information on its head. Where people once sought information to manage the real contexts of their lives, now they had to invent contexts in which otherwise useless information might be put to some apparent use. The crossword puzzle is one such pseudo-context, the cocktail party is another, the radio quiz shows of the 1930s and 1940s and the modern television game show are still others, and the ultimate, perhaps, is the wildly successful Trivial Pursuit. In one form or another, each of these supplies an answer to the question, "What am I to do with all these disconnected facts?" And in one form or another, the answer is the same. Why not use them for diversion, for entertainment, to amuse yourself in a game? In The Image, Boorstin calls the major creation of the graphic revolution the pseudo-event, by which he means an event specifically staged to be reported, like the press conference, say. I mean to suggest here that a more significant legacy of the telegraph and the photograph may be the pseudo-context. A pseudo-context is a structure invented to give fragmented and irrelevant information a seeming use. But the use the pseudo-context provides is not action or problem-solving or change. It is the only use left for information with no genuine connection to our lives. And that, of course, is to amuse. The pseudo-context is the last refuge, so to say, of a culture overwhelmed by irrelevance, incoherence, and impotence. Of course, photography and telegraphy did not strike down at one blow the vast edifice that was typographic culture. The habits of exposition, as I have tried to show, had a long history, and they held powerful sway over the minds of turn-of-the-century Americans. In fact, the early decades of the 20th century were marked by a great outpouring of brilliant language and literature. In the pages of magazines like the American Mercury and the New Yorker, in the novels and stories of Faulkner, Fitzgerald, Steinbeck, and Hemingway, and even in the columns of the newspaper giants, the Herald Tribune, the Times, prose thrilled with a vibrancy and intensity that delighted ear and eye. But this was exposition's nightingale song, most brilliant and sweet as the singer nears the moment of death. It tolled for the age of exposition not of new beginnings, but of an end. Beneath its dying melody, a new note had been sounded, and photography and telegraphy set the key. Theirs was a language that denied interconnectedness, proceeded without context, argued the irrelevance of history, explained nothing, and offered fascination in place of complexity and coherence. Theirs was a duet of image and instancy, and together they played the tune of a new kind of public discourse in America. Each of the media that entered the electronic conversation in the late 19th and early 20th centuries followed the lead of the telegraph and the photograph and amplified their biases. Some, such as film, were by their very nature inclined to do so. Others, whose bias was rather toward the amplification of rational speech, like radio, were overwhelmed by the thrust of the new epistemology and came in the end to support it. Together, this ensemble of electronic techniques called into being a new world, a peekaboo world, where now this event, now that, pops into view for a moment, then vanishes again. It is a world without much coherence or sense, a world that does not ask us, indeed does not permit us, to do anything, a world that is, like the child's game of peekaboo, entirely self-contained. But, like peekaboo, it is also endlessly entertaining. Of course, there is nothing wrong with playing peekaboo, and there is nothing wrong with entertainment. As some psychiatrist once put it, we all build castles in the air. The problems come when we try to live in them. The communications media of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, with telegraphy and photography at their center, called the peekaboo world into existence, but we did not come to live there until television. Television gave the epistemological biases of the telegraph and the photograph their most potent expression, raising the interplay of image and instancy to an exquisite and dangerous perfection, and it brought them into the home. We are by now well into a second generation of children for whom television has been their first and most accessible teacher, and for many their most reliable companion and friend. To put it plainly, television is the command center of the new epistemology. There is no audience so young that it is barred from television. There is no poverty so abject that it must forego television. There is no education so exalted that it is not modified by television. And most important of all, there is no subject of public interest, politics, news, education, religion, science, sports, that does not find its way to television, which means that all public understanding of these subjects is shaped by the biases of television. Television is the command center in subtler ways as well. Our use of other media, for example, is largely orchestrated by television. Through it, we learn what telephone system to use, what movies to see, what books, records, and magazines to buy, what radio programs to listen to. Television arranges our communications environment for us in ways that no other medium has the power to do. As a small, ironic example of this point, consider this. In the past few years, we have been learning that the computer is the technology of the future. We are told that our children will fail in school and be left behind in life if they are not computer literate. We are told that we cannot run our businesses or compile our shopping lists or keep our checkbooks tidy unless we own a computer. Perhaps some of this is true. But the most important fact about computers and what they mean to our lives is that we learn about all of this from television. Television has achieved the status of meta-medium, an instrument that directs not only our knowledge of the world, but our knowledge of ways of knowing as well. At the same time, television has achieved the status of myth, as Roland Barthes uses the word. He means by myth a way of understanding the world that is not problematic, that we are not fully conscious of, that seems, in a word, natural. A myth is a way of thinking so deeply embedded in our consciousness that it is invisible. This is now the way of television. We are no longer fascinated or perplexed by its machinery. We do not tell stories of its wonders. We do not confine our television sets to special rooms. We do not doubt the reality of what we see on television, are largely unaware of the special angle of vision it affords. Even the question of how television affects us has receded into the background. The question itself may strike some of us as strange, as if one were to ask how having ears and eyes affects us. 20 years ago, the question, does television shape culture or merely reflect it, held considerable interest for many scholars and social critics. The question has largely disappeared as television has gradually become our culture. This means, among other things, that we rarely talk about television, only about what is on television, that is, about its content. Its ecology, which includes not only its physical characteristics and symbolic code, but the conditions in which we normally attend to it, is taken for granted, accepted as natural. Television has become, so to speak, the background radiation of the social and intellectual universe, the all but imperceptible residue of the electronic Big Bang of a century past, so familiar and so thoroughly integrated with American culture that we no longer hear its faint hissing in the background or see the flickering gray light. This in turn means that its epistemology goes largely unnoticed, and the peekaboo world it has constructed around us no longer seems even strange. There is no more disturbing consequence of the electronic and graphic revolution than this, that the world as given to us through television seems natural, not bizarre. For the loss of the sense of the strange is a sign of adjustment, and the extent to which we have adjusted is a measure of the extent to which we have been changed. Our culture's adjustment to the epistemology of television is by now all but complete. We have so thoroughly accepted its definitions of truth, knowledge, and reality that irrelevance seems to us to be filled with import, and incoherence seems eminently sane. And if some of our institutions seem not to fit the template of the times, why it is they, and not the template, that seem to us disordered and strange. It is my object in the rest of this book to make the epistemology of television visible again. I will try to demonstrate by concrete example that television's way of knowing is uncompromisingly hostile to typography's way of knowing, that television's conversations promote incoherence and triviality, that the phrase serious television is a contradiction in terms, and that television speaks in only one persistent voice, the voice of entertainment. Beyond that, I will try to demonstrate that to enter the great television conversation, one American cultural institution after another is learning to speak its terms. Television, in other words, is transforming our culture into one vast arena for show business. It is entirely possible, of course, that in the end we shall find that delightful and decide we like it just fine. That is exactly what Aldous Huxley feared was coming 50 years ago.